something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man. Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, and I want to welcome you to our last broadcast for the year 2020. Next week, we will all be witnesses to an unprecedented political drama. The 117th Congress will be sworn in. The first order of business will be the certification of the next president and vice president of the United States. But for the first time in the history of our republic, a sitting president refuses to admit defeat. So tonight we ponder such questions as, what happens next week? Does Trump still have a shot at overturning the election results? If all of the president's legal tactics fail, what's next? When and if Trump finally does leave, what happens to him, to the Republican Party, and to American democracy? In other words, is this Trump's last stand? The future of your democracy could be at stake next week, so more than ever, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. That is, if you're in the Bay Area. If you're outside of the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can contact us with any legal or for tonight, any legal or political question, anything on the subject of elections, challenges to the presidential election results, challenges to our democratic process. You're not limited to the point where we may be in our conversation. And with us tonight to walk us through this latest crisis of the republic, Professor Lawrence Douglas, the James J. Grossfield Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College, is also the author of Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Electoral Meltdown in 2020, in which he described in this book what would happen if Donald Trump lost the 2020 election. And needless to say, that book now reads like prophecy. Also joining us tonight is Dean Johnson. Dean Johnson is a practicing attorney, an Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst, and the founder of Pundit Network, a social media network that uses the wisdom of the crowds to forecast the future, to forecast the news. Welcome to both for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be back with you, Jeff.
And it's a pleasure to have you both back with me. Dean, let me start with you. You said that next week will be nonstop breaking news. Can you set the stage for us?
Absolutely. You know, the late, great Yogi Berra once said, it ain't over till it's over. And that's certainly true of presidential elections. We all thought that it was over when Wolf Blitzer announced that Joe Biden would be the next president of the United States. But the final step in this process of making Joe Biden president and Kamala Harris vice president, it occurs next week. And this is also Donald Trump's last chance to raise legal challenges to the certification of the next president and vice president. So the schedule runs like this, and it's going to be very busy for those of us who are in the 24-hour news cycle. Sunday, January 3rd is the official day for the swearing-in of the 117th Congress, the Congress that we all elected on November 3rd. But this won't be the Congress as it will ultimately be constituted. There are two important differences. One is that Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States, will still sit in his capacity as President of the Senate because he is still Vice President until January 20th. The other difference is that we won't know the true makeup of the United States Senate at this time because both seats in the critical state of Georgia are still up for grabs in runoff elections. So January 3rd, we will see, is the day for the official swearing in. Most likely, they'll put over and traditionally have put over the swearing in to, until Monday, January 4th, because it makes for good photo ops. The next day, January 5th, is the date of the Georgia runoff election, which could determine the balance of power in the Senate. If Democrats take both seats, the balance of power shifts. The Senate is divided 50-50, and eventually Kamala Harris, as president of the Senate, will have the deciding vote. We should also mention that the next day, January 6th, is the day that we decide whether or not to certify the candidates, the Electoral College's votes. And that is when the drama begins, because the law provides that members of the Congress, both the House and the Senate, can object to slates of electors that have been submitted by the states that reflect the results of elections in those states. And that's where the drama begins, because we have at least two senators, Tommy Tuberville from Atlanta, from Alabama, and Josh Hawley from Missouri, who have said that they're going to buck the instructions of the House Majority Leader and begin to challenge the slates of electors from Pennsylvania and possibly from Georgia. And that's where Donald Trump's last stand may take place. So this all continues until eventually a president is certified. It could take a long time, because we do it state by state alphabetically. If it's not concluded by January 11th, Congress has to go into continuous session until the issue is decided. And of course, that only gives us a few days until January 20th, when, according to the Constitution, Donald Trump has to leave office.
And of course, that's Inauguration Day. So if I understand, this would be the time when we decide if we're going to have a President Biden, or perhaps, as I said a year ago, we might have Nancy Pelosi sworn in as interim president. And this is really where we find this out.
Yeah, this is where we find out whether we reach a constitutional meltdown. And if we get to the point of actually objecting and a floor fight, and there comes arises a legal dispute as to whether the votes from the Electoral College are accepted. If there is a legitimate dispute, which seems almost impossible to happen, but if that were to happen, then we get to the kind of meltdown that was so prophetically described in Professor Douglas's book.
So with that backdrop, let me turn to Professor Douglas. You painted a vivid picture of a constitutional meltdown happening after the election and reaching a climax when Congress convenes to count the electoral votes, and Trump has lost, as you assumed he would in your book. Since then, have events unfolded as you envisioned?
I would say yes and no. For one thing, I don't think anyone can doubt my capacity to imagine catastrophic scenarios. Yet I do think that we're going to get past January 6th without having the real meltdown. That is, I think we're going to continue to see that there are members of the GOP who don't really support democratic constitutional governance. That is, they're going to raise challenges to the certification of these electors from the states. But I don't see those challenges really gaining any traction. They're deeply, deeply troubling, notwithstanding, but I do not see them really triggering any type of a larger constitutional crisis. And I'd be happy to expand on that. One thing I think we all need to bear in mind is, notwithstanding the fact that Trump has engaged in this unprecedented and, disgraceful attack on our electoral system, I think we need to kind of stand back and just remind ourselves of how well the election actually ran. It actually was a really well-run and smooth election, conducted in a time of great challenges, given the fact that we had an election against the backdrop of a pandemic. And I think that had the election gone more sideways, that is, had we had greater reports of irregularities on election day, then we might have seen a true meltdown, because I think Trump's allegations of fraud and impropriety would have gained greater traction. But we've seen that the courts have held steady. He's brought a barrage of lawsuits, none of which have really basically been able to get to first base. And we've seen GOP lawmakers and GOP election officials, at least in the states, standing up to the pressures that have been brought by Trump as he spins his conspiracy theories. So even though I do think January 6th is going to present us with an unseemly display of GOP lawmakers challenging the electoral certificates of various states, I really don't see them ultimately gaining any traction and ultimately having any impact on Joe Biden's inauguration on January 20th.
Yeah, I think I would have to agree with Professor Douglas. The scenarios are out there, and we're certainly going to be treated to some political theater next week. But that's all it is. And that's, you know, that's the way it's going. But it's important to understand the political dynamics of what's going on behind the scenes. The Republican Party is very much at stake here. And we're going to see in this Senate where either Democrats have a majority or Republicans have a bare majority, I think we're going to see some of those Republicans jumping to the Democratic side to vote for certification so this process can go ahead. Mitt Romney has already said that he intends to vote to certify. Probably Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins of Maine, Chuck Grassley, who is the president pro tem of the Senate and who will ultimately, the senior member of the Senate and will ultimately be retiring. That's enough to make a majority and get all of these certificates certified. But remember what's going on here is that people like Romney and Murkowski and Collins are casting their lot according to what they think the future of the Republican Party is going to be. And people like Josh Hawley and Tommy Tuberville are also casting their lot. The more moderate Republicans think that we're going to return to a more traditional Republican Party. People like Hawley and Tuberville think that Donald Trump is going to be the leader of the party going towards 2024, that he may not run, and they would hope to be his successors. So even though this is theater, there's an important political dynamic going on behind the scenes. And what Trump is doing, I think, mostly is creating a mythology here. Remember that Donald Trump, in this election, got more votes than he did in the 2016 election. There are 70 million people out there, many of whom actually believe that this election was stolen and that Donald Trump's right to re-election was divinely ordained, and he's trying to cement that that base. And the Republican Party absolutely needs that base. So the theater is an essential part of this political dynamic.
So if I understand you correctly, a lot of this is in order to maintain the base that they can't do without. Very much like the last 4 years, we've seen moderate Republicans that embrace Trump's platform when privately they disagree with a lot of the ideas, but they can't disaffect a portion of their own voting base and hand over their seat to the next person to run against them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Republican Party is really in a dilemma here. And I think we saw this dilemma illustrated best today when the House Majority Leader Mitch McConnell found himself in a squeeze within his own party between people who want to go forward with an enhanced stimulus package and people who kept recanting the old Republican ideology of let's not increase the deficit, let's minimize government spending. I think that shows the fault line in the Republican Party. They have made a bargain in which they need a constituency that's dependent upon things like the $20,000 enhanced stimulus package. In Mitch McConnell's own state, people are desperate for that kind of stimulus. It's a poor state. It's suffering from COVID. It's suffering from the economic downturn, and they need that. And so, and that's Mitch McConnell's constituency. But as a Republican, as a traditional Republican, he has to. All he has in his bag of tricks is the tired old discredited rhetoric about let's cut back on government spending and it's too much money and so on and so forth. So the Republican Party's got to decide, you know, which way do you go? And neither fork in that road leads to anything good, I think, for the Republican Party.
Let's take a step back in a moment. I want to start with analyzing what we're likely to see next week, exactly how this plays out. But first, I would like to give people a chance to call in if you wish. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we look ahead to an unprecedented political drama as we discuss President Trump's last stand with Professor Lawrence Douglas, the James J. Grossfeld Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College, author of Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Electoral Meltdown in 2020, and Dean Johnson, practicing attorney and Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst and the founder of Pundit Network. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling outside of the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any legal or for tonight political discussion on tonight's topic, whether it be the last salvo launched by the president and his allies, or the last vestige of our democracy. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. So, is there going to be will there really be objections next week?
Yes, it does seem like there will be objections next week. And just so that we're clear about what really happens next week, so this is largely it's typically a ceremonial function that the joint session of Congress performs. They basically, president of the Senate, in this case, Vice President Pence, he will open these electoral certificates that have been mailed to him very quaintly by certified mail. So he will actually open these electoral certificate. He will hand it to four people who are called tellers, two from the House and two from the Senate. And then he will inventory the states in alphabetical order and ask the tellers to examine the certificates and basically tally up the results. And it just, again, as I said, it goes through alphabetical order and it is meant to be a ceremony. In this particular case, it will not simply be ceremonial because federal law does provide for challenges to electoral certificates. And the way that process works is that if a member of the House and a member of the Senate both have in written form raised challenges to an electoral certificate, then according to federal law, the two bodies have to divide and they get to debate the merits of the challenge for 2 hours and then they reconvene to decide. So you can't get a challenge unless you have challenges issuing from both a member of the House and a member of the Senate. And we've known for weeks now that there are going to be, you know, potentially dozens of members of the House who are going to raise challenges. I mean, you have people like Mo Brooks of Alabama. And then also, as Dean mentioned, we know now that it seems that at least two senators will also raise these challenges. We have Tommy Tuberville, this is what Dean mentioned, and now just recently, I think Josh Hawley, the junior senator from Missouri, he also announced that he will be raising challenges. Mitch McConnell who's not happy with that at all. He does not want these challenges to proceed, because ultimately what they do is they create a situation which, instead of something rubber stamping a fait accompli that Biden has won, it suddenly creates a situation in which basically senators, members of the Republican Party, will have to vote either to be for or against Trump. That's not really what they're voting for. They're really voting for, just protecting the integrity of the American electoral system. But it will take the form of basically an up and down vote for Donald Trump. And so it'll be almost this kind of like this demonstration of fealty to the king. And Trump wants that, and Mitch McConnell, for obvious reasons, is desperate to avoid that kind of situation.
Let me turn it over to Kolya in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, first I want to wish everyone, hopefully, a Happy New Year.
Thank you, and to you as well. And I, too, I'm very hopeful that we will get there.
Yes, me too. Anyway, my question is, and I'm not the only one that, that's heard this two words before, but the behavior of Trump, obviously, for the last 4 years, and, his desperation here at the last moment, running against the clock here. My concern is martial law. Is that probably something out of line here, or is that something that possibly could happen? A little bit concerned about that.
No, actually, it's something that we were going to talk about later in the program, and it's a it's a serious concern. Members, high-ranking members of the military, have expressed concern about what may happen in that period after Joe Biden is certified as president, and Trump is still in office, which is a period of about 2 weeks. And we've already seen in the past that Donald Trump, without officially declaring martial law, has been willing to put troops on the street. Remember, he had what we called his secret police of guys in riot gear with no agency identification riding around in unmarked SUVs and taking people off the streets. I mean, those guys didn't evaporate. They're out there somewhere. And members of the military, as I've said, have expressed concern that these people may return. I have no doubt that the military, if ordered to impose martial law, would say, Mr. President, that's an illegal order and we're not going to do it. We're not your troops. We swear an allegiance not to you personally, but to the Constitution, and we're not going to do it. But we know that Trump has been willing to circumvent the military and put armed law enforcement agents on the street if he doesn't like what's going on. So it is a concern. There are other concerns. It has been reported that Trump has seriously considered fomenting some sort of international incident in order to say, look, I'm now a wartime president. It's too serious for me to leave, and I'm not leaving. Of course, Joe Biden has responded by saying, well, I will be the president, and I do have the Secret Service, and they're very good at removing trespassers from the grounds of the White House. So, yeah, it's a serious concern.
Kolya, I hope we answered your question somewhat, but we're really going to be covering this in greater detail later in the program. So, Professor, I'm going to let you go ahead, but Kolya, we will welcome your call to call back later on in the course of the program tonight.
Yeah, I just have a very small comment to add to what Dean's already said in response to the question about martial law. We should also bear in mind that I think it was just early last week, or maybe it was towards the end of the week before, that Michael Flynn was in a meeting in the White House in which he suggested to the president that he declare martial law, and that he said that the military basically should seize election machines and basically should have the military rerun the 2020 election. And as far as we can tell, it was Trump's lawyers sitting around saying, excuse me, Mr. Flynn, but we really, that's not a legal thing to do. But still, I mean, you had this disgraced and pardoned former national security advisor suggesting that the president engage in precisely this kind of action.
And in the day or two that followed, he went on national television saying that it's okay, the National Guard's been used for martial law 64 times in our history, and that somehow justifies the president using the military to throw out an election and to say, I want a do-over. I'm not happy with the results. Let me turn it over to Alicia in Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the program. I have a question about even further out from what I hope is going to be a fairly peaceful transition. But once Biden actually is president, there are still 74 million people who looked at the last 4 years and had said, let's have more of this. And I'm really concerned about them because it seems like there's a wave of conspiracy theories that are running through those, you know, those people who voted for Trump. And my concern is that, for example, many of my friends who are Trumpites are saying they're not going to get the vaccination because it's all a hoax. So there are, like, very real consequences to the sort of disengagement and the way that these people feel like they're not going to be heard and their reaction to it. And I'm just wondering what your guests think of that, and especially what they think of Biden's ability to bring the country together, because that seems so critical right now.
Professor, do you have a feeling about whether President Biden can help heal the wounds and bring us together?
Well, let's be instead of predictive, let's be hopeful. And say, at the very least, it's good to have a president who is dedicated to that task rather than one who's made his signature politics based on a division and teardown. So, you know, given the fact that we have this, you know, basically a decent human being installed in the White House who's dedicated to trying to bring us together, all we can do is wish him the best. But I do think that Alicia raises a very important point, which is to say that even once Trump leaves the White House and Biden becomes the next president, it will continue to be the case that tens of millions of people will question the legitimacy of his presidency, or not simply question it, but will truly doubt the legitimacy of his presidency because they will have bought into this conspiracy theory that Trump has peddled and that the Republican leadership has not opposed. And to just connect this to a point that Dean had made earlier about the future of the Republican Party, depending on what we see in the future, it might be the case that every Republican will, in a sense, almost have to genuflect before this this conspiracy theory myth that the 2020 election was stolen from them. That is, in any in 2024, in order for a Republican candidate to have any kind of validity, they were going to have to kind of buy into this narrative that Trump spread. And that's what we already see with people like Hawley and Tuberville of, you know, standing behind the president's lies. And those lies then become part of this this mythology going forward.
Doesn't it seem that people should be listening to the fact that he started this story of election fraud and having been robbed of his presidency 4 months before the election was actually held?
Well, they could say he can say he has unusual predictive powers. I mean, the idea that we're going to bring to bear a reality principle for the purposes of trying to demonstrate that that the claim of a rigged election is false. I think we have to disabuse ourselves that we're going to be able to use any kind of reality or fact testing for the purposes of trying to disabuse people of that belief, particularly when, again, it's not simply one person who is articulating this falsehood. It's a falsehood which is gaining traction because of the either cynicism or cowardice of members of the Republican leadership.
And like a child playing with matches, sometimes the fire tends to spread.
Yeah, I have to agree with Professor Douglas, and I'm even more pessimistic. You know, when people see their charismatic leader fail, when a Donald Trump is not elected, there's a phenomenon that sets in called cognitive dissonance. Their beliefs become even stronger. And I personally have contact. I have friends and relatives who are supporters of Trump, and that's exactly what's happening. Their beliefs are essentially non-falsifiable. They're becoming stronger in their beliefs that the election was stolen. And that's going to continue. And it's going to be fed and reinforced not only by Donald Trump and the Republican Party, by Fox News, by the new news outlets like News One and Newsmax that are even further to the right than Fox News, and frankly, by disinformation peddled even by foreign influences. So I am extremely pessimistic. I know a lot of these people plan to actually demonstrate on January 6th when they expect that that Joe Biden will be certified, and I don't think they're going to go away.
Thomas in San Francisco, if you stand by just a moment, we'll be to you next. For right now, we need to take a very brief break. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Let me turn us to Thomas in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, I just want to say overall I'm optimistic that we're going to get to January 20th with, some struggle, but I think we're going to get there. However, I do have a kind of question about if President-elect Biden were to be, had an accident or was incapacitated before, what happens in terms of, if it's before January 6th or after, what happens in terms of who succeeds him, who follows him? So not to be pessimistic, but I just am like, oh, so much has happened in this year. What if that happens? That's my question.
What happens to agriculture if the locusts land? Do either of you really share that sense of pessimism?
Well, I don't. I don't think there are going to be any accidents that happen, and there are provisions for dealing with that, depending on the timing of an accident, if God forbid something should happen. Remember, Americans have never voted for a president. No American has ever cast a single vote for a president. We cast a vote for a slate of electors, and that slate of electors can be instructed to change their vote, say to, if Biden were to be unavailable, to change their vote to Kamala Harris, who could then conceivably be certified. But it depends a lot on the timing and whether Biden has been actually certified and Harris certified or if it happens before that. Suffice it to say, it's a pretty complicated situation.
Yeah.
Okay. And if I could just add something to that, I think Dean's right. And I think the period to that your question really could have created a lot of concerns is, let's say, from the time of that Biden was seemed to have captured the Electoral College vote, in early November, until the time that the Electoral College, members of the Electoral College met on December 14th. But we now have a president and a vice president elect. And, if God forbid something happened to Biden between January 6th and January 20th, by the terms of the Presidential Succession Act of 1947, Vice President Kamala Harris would simply become the next president of the United States. So we have so many things to worry about. Fortunately, it's always nice when we can answer a question saying, well, we don't really need to worry about that one too much. So,
and with that, Thomas, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. And yes, you are listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we are looking ahead to an unprecedented political drama as we've been discussing President Trump's last stand with Professor Lawrence Douglas, the James J. Grossfeld Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College, author of Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Electoral Meltdown in 2020, and Dean Johnson, practicing attorney and Emmy-nominated, that's a tongue twister, Dean, Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst, and the founder of Pundit Network, a social media network that uses the wisdom of the crowds to forecast the news and the future. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're not in the local dialing area, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any legal or for tonight, any legal or political question on tonight's topic, whether it be the last salvo to be launched by the president and his allies or the last vestige of our democracy, whether our democracy, for that matter, is going to survive in the same fashion as we knew it. You're not limited at the point we may be in our conversation. We talked a little bit about objections that were likely. What specific objections are likely to be raised?
Well, the statute, the Electoral Count Act that governs this, gives a very vague term. It says objections can be made if the slate of electors is not, quote, regularly given, unquote. But what that means is anybody's guess. There's no precedent. We know that one of the senators who plans to object is going to raise an objection about the way social media handled news election or news content about the election. That doesn't sound like what the drafters of that statute intended, but conceivably any perceived or even made up irregularity can be raised as an objection.
Yeah, I think Dean is exactly right about that. Basically, if you have a member of the House and a member of the Senate both want to raise objections, they can raise objections. Now, one thing that we should also bear in mind is, you know, the idea of having a president who is refusing to acknowledge electoral defeat is unprecedented. And even raising challenges, even though it's a relatively simple process, it hasn't happened very often in our history. It happened in 1969 once. It happened again in 2005. But for example, it didn't even happen in 2000. It didn't happen in 2000, or I should say 2001, because that's when Congress met. But in the wake of the, you know, near electoral meltdown of the Bush-Gore election, you didn't have any challenges to Florida's electoral certificate. And the reason you didn't have it is because the president of the Senate at the time was Al Gore himself. And Al Gore really put the interests of the nation ahead of his own political fortune and instructed Democratic senators not to challenge the certificate from Florida. So it's a relatively easy thing to do to raise these challenges. But that said, it hasn't happened very often. And it returns us to the point that Dean made earlier, which is it will make for political drama, for great political theater, but it's not going to have any kind of legal or constitutional consequence with regards to the outcome of this election.
Yeah, and one of the great stories about raising objections and one of our great historical ironies were that there were objections actually raised after the 2016 election between Clinton and Donald Trump. And when those objections were raised by Democrats who were stung by the defeat of Hillary Clinton, the president of the Senate put down his gavel and said, "It's over." And the great irony is the president of the Senate at that time was Joe Biden.
Exactly.
What type of numbers are needed to overrule or sustain these objections?
You would basically need, in a circumstance like this, you'd basically need to have at least one of the houses vote in support of the challenge. And even in a situation like this, you don't really have, it gets a little bit technical, but you don't really have a situation of competing electoral certificates. But let's put it this way, without having at least one of the houses voting in support of the challenge, then it will get absolutely nowhere.
You know, and I have a question for Professor Douglas. And as I read the Electoral Count Act, it's really a hole in the law as to what happens if the houses disagree. Yes, we don't know what happens then.
Well, again, that's—I don't think that's. This is where the little technical thing is. If, for example, Pennsylvania had submitted two conflicting certificates, one for Trump, one for Biden, and they had both, in a sense, been legally certified. Then if you have a divided Congress, let's say the Senate recognizes Trump's certificate and the House recognizes Biden's certificate, in that situation, we're kind of in a stalemate. There's some suggestion that it's the governor's certificate that should actually win the day. But again, it's the whole law is a little bit murky about this type of technicality. But in this particular situation, in which you don't have conflicting certificates, it really seems that in order to, let's say, not recognize Pennsylvania's electoral certificate for Biden, you would need both houses. You'd need both houses to sign on to that proposition, and there's no way that's going to happen.
So it seems, just counting the numbers, that neither house is likely to sustain the objections. If both houses overrule the objections, is it over?
Yes.
Yeah, it's essentially over then. Then the candidate is certified as president or vice president, as the case may be. So that part is over, but then we move to the part that we started to discuss earlier, which is now that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been certified, Donald Trump still has 2 weeks to sit in office, and what happens then?
Exactly. And actually, if I can just add one little thing, something, you know, it's just kind of an example of, I guess you can get lawyers to basically make an argument about anything. But one thing that, you know, is also on the back burner right now is that, you know, a Texas Republican lawmaker, this Louis Gohmert, he has brought suit against Vice President Pence. He has brought suit against Vice President Pence, and he basically makes this what I could say is novel in a very euphemistic description of an argument that really is incoherent and ungrounded. But his argument is basically that the vice president can disqualify the Electoral College votes of any state that he disagrees with. And again, that's a suit that right now is before a federal judge. But it shows that the efforts to kind of to use every legal means possible for the purpose of trying to overturn a democratic outcome are still being explored by these renegade Republicans.
Yeah. And of course, Donald Trump has tried to put pressure even on his vice president to do something like that. But it's really clear under the statutes that the vice president at that point in his role as president of the Senate has nothing more than a ministerial duty. His job is to open the envelopes, hand them to the tellers, and announce the total. And that's essentially it.
Exactly.
And to try and keep some order in the proceedings and maybe hit the gavel once in a while. But for the most part, unless he's breaking a tie, and it doesn't sound like we're heading for a tie. Is there any likelihood of this ending up before the Supreme Court?
I would think, given the history of Trump's litigiousness and his allies in Congress, that at least one person from the Congress or Senate may think about trying to go to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court has its own dynamic going. I mean, Donald Trump is now, by my count, 0-3. In the presently constituted Supreme Court since Amy Coney Barrett took her seat. And they're not going to be making any crazy rulings in favor of Donald Trump. They've got their own agenda, and they sit atop a separate and co-equal branch of government. They don't need or want Donald Trump at this point, so I suspect anything that got there would be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I think generally, I think a lot of people would say that once an electoral dispute lands in Congress's lap, it's really Congress's responsibility to figure things out, that the Supreme Court is not going to be intervening at that moment. And again, it is, you know, I suppose you can always make some kind of, as we've seen, specious, incoherent legal argument to try to get the attention of the Supreme Court. But as Dean has pointed out, Trump to date has been singularly unsuccessful in trying to get the court to support any of his baseless claims.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that any case that went to the Supreme Court would ask the court to interpret the Electoral Count Act, which Congress itself enacted, and the court has been very reluctant to tell Congress what Congress meant when it wrote a statute.
You know, a caller that did not want to remain on the air but sent me a question, and this is from Hank in Santa Cruz, is looking past Inauguration Day and presuming that we have a President Biden waking up in the White House on the 21st of January. His questions look a little beyond that. Before leaving office, do you believe that President Trump can issue a blanket pardon to himself?
I think the answer is yes, but it'll be subject to some substantial legal challenges. If it ultimately went to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court took jurisdiction over it, I think the answer would be no, you can't pardon yourself.
I would agree with that. It seems like whatever the framers of the Constitution had in mind in creating this pardon power, it certainly was not meant to be applied in a kind of self-applying manner. The other thing also to bear in mind is, recall the pardon would only extend to federal criminal charges, and Trump would still be face legal exposure to whatever charges, for example, the Manhattan DA, Cyrus Vance Jr., might be, you know, theoretically preparing against him.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And a while ago, I went back and actually read the debates that the framers had about the Constitution. One thing to remember is that one of their inspirations was a work by John Locke called The Second Treatise on Government. And it begins with the sentence, "A man shall not be the judge in his own case." And that's what Donald Trump would be doing if he were pardoning himself. So I think there's a little bit of, shall we say, legislative intent there.
And of course, for those that aren't aware, wasn't it John Locke that was cited in our founding, both the Constitution and as well as the Declaration of Independence, made reference to words that were quoted to John Locke, such as life, liberty, and originally it was life, liberty, and property. I didn't think that would have sold in this case. The other question that Hank had was whether you see any likelihood that the president will resign a little before inauguration date to give Vice President Pence an opportunity to pardon him.
Again, I've heard that speculation numerous times. I don't think so. You know, one of the things is that you should also bear in mind is if you do accept a pardon, accepting a pardon basically is a tantamount to a recognition of guilt. I just don't see Trump doing that. I really don't see Trump. I mean, it's a sign of weakness. It's a sign of vulnerability on Trump's part. So I could more easily imagine him engaging in a constitutionally questionable act of auto-pardoning before I could imagine him resigning simply in order to be the beneficiary of a pardon from his vice president, which, as we've already noted, wouldn't eliminate his exposure to state criminal charges anyway.
And of course, Trump has been known to say, "Well, why should I get a pardon? I haven't done anything wrong."
Just keep denying. Let me turn it to Laney in San Francisco. Welcome to your legal rights.
Hi, thank you. Great program. Well, a couple things. One, a friend pointed out to me that X number of million people didn't vote necessarily for Trump. They voted for, some of them voted for their own interests. And in light of that, a lot of the members of the GOP have been saying, oh, you're so wonderful, because they don't want to get primaried. And they don't want his base to attack them. But once they have to take this kind of loyalty test and either say, oh, yes, the election was stolen from you, sir, or not, then the game is afoot, right, as far as them no longer being favored by him. And I'm wondering, given that many of the people involved have their own political ambitions, what do you think might start to happen after that? Do you have any thoughts about that? And, again, thanks for a great program.
Lainey, thank you for joining us. Let me turn it first to Dean.
Yeah, well, the thing you have to remember, as I said before, is that the Republican Party cannot survive without the Trump base. The Republicans decades ago made a decision to peel off blue-collar, working-class, white voters from the Democratic coalition, and it's that coalition, it's that group that forms the base of the Republican Party. And for many, many, many of those people, Donald Trump is the charismatic leader. They come out to support Donald Trump because they like his style. They like that he, quote, speaks their language. What's likely to happen is if Donald Trump passes the banner to someone else, or if the Republican Party goes back to its old conservative roots, those people are going to become non-voters again. One of the reasons that polls were so off in these last two elections is simply that polls look at likely voters. Donald Trump depends, and the Republican Party now depends, on those unlikely voters, and they're going to go away without Trump or somebody who is Trump's designated heir apparent.
You know, I'd like to add a little bit to the caller's question and to Dean's comments and bounce this by you, Professor. But I don't necessarily myself agree with the premise that all of these voters are diehard Trump supporters. I think the president and his allies have spent an awful lot of time over the last year seeing what's happening to his base given the pandemic, and has been really working to charge people up by painting a picture of a socialist takeover led by soon-to-be President Biden, who himself is being led by a real leftist base. And as it does not take that form in office, as he has formed most of the cabinet already, a lot of his base that's going to be working with him in the White House does not include such folks from such progressive places. Do you think that a lot of those voters that voted for President Trump would start to peel off as they see that it's not a socialist takeover and they begin to see what a moderate government looks like?
I think you, Jeff, you have a what I would say is a endearing fidelity to the power of truth and reason. And, you know, I do think, sure, obviously there's some people who will see that, oh, my God, look at this. We're not living in a Soviet-style state under Joe Biden. But I do worry about the continuing power of the base that Trump has organized and mobilized. And I think, again, this is why I worry that this almost kind of stab in the back myth, similar to what you saw in, let's say, in Weimar Germany in 1918,
I couldn't find it.
Will take hold, that they'll become this kind of almost this article of faith among members of the Republican Party that the 2020 election was rigged and that the result was a election that was stolen from Donald Trump. And that is going to be some part of, that will be a critical part of Republican politics going forward in 2022 in midterms, and then more emphatically in 2024. And that exactly in order not to be primaried out, every Republican candidate is going to have to buy into what really is kind of a noxious myth that that threatens the heart of our constitutional democracy.
You know, as we feared, we had a lot more material than we had time on the clock. So it's really, really down to a point where I need to ask you each to spend a couple minutes for any closing thoughts that you have. But in the short time remaining, which is less than about 2 minutes each, maybe a little less, do you have any thoughts about what's going to happen to the Republican Party after this contest is over?
Well, I have a certain amount of optimism here. I see a possible hopeful scenario that we're turning into what we might call a swing vote society. I think it's real clear that people to the right of a Donald Trump are not going to be jumping over to the Democratic Party. And similarly, people to the left of a Joe Biden aren't going to become Republicans. But it's those people in the middle, those people who can be persuaded one way or the other, that ultimately are going to determine elections. They are few and far between. Their numbers are dwindling. But so far, moderates like Joe Biden have been able to scoop up those voters. And that's the way Joe Biden won this election by 8 million votes. I think as we go forward, we're going to see more of that. That's good in that it gives us a group of people who can determine an election, who can be persuaded one way or the other. What's bad about that is it puts an extraordinary amount of power in the hands of a very small number of people.
Professor, do you agree?
I would like to agree, because Dean and I have basically been agreeing about everything. But I guess I'm just maybe constitutionally a little bit more pessimistic. And I just worry that a Donald Trump or Donald Trump 2.0 is going to remain a powerful force in Republican politics in the years to come. And that the having discovered this recipe of governance through division, tear down, hate, and attacking basic premises of constitutional democracy, and seeing the political dividends that can be reaped by pursuing this type of politics, that we're going to see a whole group of Republicans following in Trump's footsteps, if not seeing Trump himself trying to restage some kind of dramatic comeback, or at least threatening to restage a comeback in 2024 with the effect of basically freezing the entire field of Republicans.
But, you know, we've seen populists before, and isn't this whole position that he's taken throughout the last course of his presidency, isn't it pretty opportunistic? I mean, isn't he really the person that was best equipped to take advantage of the divisions in our society that had already been starting? And perhaps that opportunity won't be there if we I know truth won't prevail, but maybe some moderation might.
Okay, I'm convinced. We have to. It's the end of the year, so we have to end on a note of optimism. So yes, I will share the hopes, even despite my constitutional pessimism.
Like a good movie, sometimes we're called upon to suspend disbelief. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been discussing Trump's last stand. My guests tonight have been Professor Lawrence Douglas of Amherst College, author of Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown of 2020, and Emmy-nominated legal and political commentator Dean Johnson. I'd like to thank both of you, thank each of you for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Jeff. My pleasure, as always.
Yes, pleasure to be back with you.
And please be sure to join us next week on Your Legal Rights at 6 p.m., where, with Lord willing, the election finally settled, we'll be able to discuss common real property issues and neighborhood disputes. Once again, thanks to our distinguished guests, Dean Johnson and Professor Douglas, and our thanks to all of you for joining us. And at the controls, Debbie Kennedy, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night. Stay safe.